Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Today, we'll hear about standardized testing in Oregon. Some younger students are already taking the new and federally mandated tests. High schoolers will be taking them soon. Some are questioning the time these Common Core tests will take. Oregon State Deputy Superintendent Rob Saxon says Smarter Balanced has its strengths, but...
To be honest with you, I wish the Smarter Balanced assessment were shorter, and I'm pushing the consortium right now to make it into a shorter assessment. I think it takes too much time.
Rob Manning visits a high school classroom in Beaverton for comments from teachers and students. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Standardized student testing is being revamped in Oregon. Tests called Smarter Balanced are intended to measure proficiencies in ways traditional multiple choice tests cannot. Rob Manning reports on questions about the time these Common Core tests will take.
I wouldn't have approached it that way. Or did you?
An American flag, a University of Oregon banner, and posters with literary terms hang in the front of David Wilkinson's room at Beaverton's Westview High, a typical English class. Wilkinson is leading his 11th graders through a college admissions essay.
We know this person got into Tufts. Is there anything she did in it that you wouldn't...
What's different this year is they're judging the essay against a scoring guide or rubric for the new Smarter Balanced language exam. That's the rigorous set of new tests in Oregon and 16 other states.
When I'm just looking at word choice, and again, on this column, in the language and vocabulary column on that rubric, she does...
Part of junior English is going beyond the nuts and bolts of writing. Wilkinson points out a subtle turn in the sample student essay.
She talks about Spanish and Ghanaian music. Oh, she's not coming out and saying it, but she, to some degree, is implying, I value diversity.
Smarter Balanced is meant to test both writing mechanics and the subtleties. It's not the multiple-choice tests high schoolers are used to.
Well, it's more like inference, I guess. So I've never really had a test like that before.
Westview junior Brooke Garcelon says not only is the test different, it comes at a tough time. Oregon used to give a shorter and easier state test sophomore year. Garcelon's a little stressed.
Especially for juniors, because we have all those other tests and the school wants us to do like a lot of college prep with that. The Smarter Balance is kind of just a thing that's been added on to all of that, and it's kind of like,
We're looking at May as being kind of like testing May.
Gene Brunack teaches AP English at Madison High School in Portland.
What's really happening for a Portland Public High School 11th grader is that they'll be taking a district-required ACT exam. That happens April 28th. That's right about the time the window opens up.
Smarter Balanced may take 9 hours on top of the ACT, SAT, AP exams, and special tests for students learning English, for instance. Brunack counts 20 hours of tests for some students, and it's anticipated many students won't pass Smarter Balanced. A month before high schoolers even take the tests, Brunack learned one of his students was experiencing anxiety.
Because she read and also picked up on some of the information that indicated that a lot of students were going to struggle and perhaps fail, and she wasn't taking that well.
Brunack suspects many students will put more effort into exams colleges look at, like AP tests and the ACT, than for Smarter Balanced, which is just one of three ways to achieve a graduation requirement. State Deputy Superintendent Rob Saxton says Smarter Balanced has its strengths, but...
To be honest with you, I wish the Smarter Balanced assessment were shorter, and I'm pushing the consortium right now to make it into a shorter assessment. I think it takes too much time.
David Wilkinson, the Beaverton English teacher, says he's uncomfortable with how testing and preparation is affecting class time.
If I put all that together, it's probably about a month of instruction. That's a lot of time.
It's not lost time, Wilkinson says, but it means looking at English more in the context of a test, and it might mean dropping a novel or maybe less writing time. Student poems cover the back of Wilkinson's class. A boy writes about his dream of playing Major League Baseball. A girl fumes about the people who insist on guessing her ethnicity and get it wrong. Another shares the grief of losing a grandparent. They're handwritten. They measure self-improvement by erasure marks.
See you later.
The high school testing window opens in April.
I'm Rob Manning reporting.
Oregon lawmakers came into the session revved up about the need for new revenue to pay for improvements to roads and bridges. The money could come in the form of a hike on the gas tax, but bipartisan talks have sputtered over concerns about a separate bill that Republicans say will also raise the price of gas. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman reports.
When you ask Beaverton Mayor Denny Doyle about the state of roads in his city, his answer? Get in the car. Doyle takes me on a tour of bridges and intersections that he says need work. Most of the time, traffic hums along.
It's only when we have a problem that people really notice, and that's our mission, is to let people know that we have these challenges everywhere.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not a very sexy topic.
No.
Also along for the ride is Beaverton transportation planner Todd Juhas.
You've arrived at your destination.
Okay, stop navigating. Thank you.
And to drive home the point that this isn't a sexy topic, we soon find ourselves picking our way through the mud on the bank of Fano Creek. We take shelter from the rain underneath a bridge. The nondescript span is so low we have to bend over double. It's so low, in fact, that the creek routinely floods here, cutting off the only access to a bustling industrial area. And Yuha says those floodwaters are taking their toll. He points to damage on the underside caused by frequent floods.
And over time, it just forces these joints to wear out. And you can see some areas where rebar is starting to show. And there's significant wear on this bridge.
Yuha says without a fix, the city will have to put a weight restriction on the bridge in a few years. He says that would be a huge inconvenience to the companies that use the street. Like many other cities and counties in Oregon, Beaverton officials are casting an eye toward Salem. But at this point, what are they likely to get?
Not one dime for a road. Not one dime for a bridge.
House GOP leader Mike McClain near the end of a five-hour debate.
And to what end?
Representative, you're at time.
Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Representative.
McClain was the only one raising his voice, but he wasn't the only Republican who feels that way. The House was debating a bill that would make fuel producers lower the amount of carbon in their products. State analysts predict it will increase the cost of gas by up to 19 cents a gallon, none of which, as Representative McClain shouted, will go to infrastructure. After it passed, Republicans walked out of talks aimed at crafting a bipartisan transportation package. Democrats need at least one Republican vote to approve a hike in the gas tax. GOP Representative Cliff Bent says there's no reason to even participate in the talks, since any tax hike would likely get referred to voters who could take an even dimmer view.
It's not enough to go try to find one vote, add it to all 35 Democrats and pass this thing, because it would get referred and it would fail.
Bent says negotiators were looking at a gas tax increase of 6 to 10 cents a gallon before Republicans left the talks. He says a hike of that size was a heavy lift, politically speaking, even before the low-carbon fuel standard was signed into law.
The idea of a gas tax increase is something that most people don't want to think about or support, which is too bad because we've got to pay for our roads. There's no doubt about it.
A spokeswoman for Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek says Democrats are still committed to finding common ground on a transportation package, and she says the group that's still working on the proposal has not decided on a specific funding mechanism at this point. I'm Chris Lehman in Salem.
Some aging veterans of World War II are embarking on one more mission related to that long-ago war. In some cases, wives or children are taking on the mission if the vet has passed away. The object is to return Japanese flags taken as war souvenirs from Pacific battlefields. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports on an emotional gesture of peace and reconciliation.
Back in World War II, Woodburn, Oregon's Buck Wetherell fought across the beaches and jungles of Southeast Asia with the U.S. Army's 41st Infantry. After one bloody engagement late in the war, he says he and his comrades looked for souvenirs on the battlefield.
We saw a dead Japanese soldier. The flag was on his pocket and sticking out, and I took it off him.
The white spaces on the Japanese flag Wetherell picked up were bedecked with calligraphy. personal messages from the soldiers' family and friends. This war prize was so common, it has an English name, a good luck flag. 70 years pass. Buck Wetherill is now 93 years old. At the suggestion of his daughters, he decided to try to return the captured memento to the dead soldier's family.
I just thought, you know, the war's over, we're not enemies anymore, we're friends, and they should get the flag back.
And they did. And they're not the only ones. The Japanese consulates in Seattle, Portland, and elsewhere have gotten dozens of inquiries, American veterans or their wives or children asking how to return war memorabilia. And now a Northwest-based nonprofit has sprung up. A Japanese-American couple from Nacelle, Washington, Rex and Keiko Zeke, co-founded the group Obon 2015 to facilitate the return of flags.
Each one is, in most cases, the last surviving trace of that one individual. And back home are wives, children, brothers and sisters who lost that person and nothing ever came back.
The Zeke's send the inscribed flags back with help from Japan. Scholars, government ministry workers, a veterans group, and an association of Shinto priests pore over high-resolution digital scans for clues. Rex Zeke compares the task to identifying the owner of a yearbook from the notes scribbled inside the cover 7 decades later.
So I'm honored now very much to introduce a veteran of the 41st Signal Company.
Earlier this week, the Zekes organized what they called a returning ceremony in the Northwest for the first time.
My mother and I present this Yusaki Hinamaru to the Japanese people and hopefully to its return. I promise I wasn't going to do this.
The emotional scene played out at the old train depot in Astoria, Oregon, where once troops shipped out. World War II vets, or sons and daughters, like Jeremy Bassett there, and Elaine Locke, turned over 5 flags.
It's difficult to let go of it, and is one of the few things I have left of my father. But if it were his, and I lost him in a war, I would want it back.
Keiko Zeke wiped away tears as she accepted the flags. It brings the number her nonprofit has received to nearly 100. Of those, original owners' families have been identified for about 25.
Thank you.
This might be the last recognition some of these families will get. The rest of the repatriation process is usually confidential, and some Japanese families don't want contact. Hiroshi Furusawa is the Japanese consul general in Portland. He told the Americans at the returning ceremony that regardless, they were doing a wonderful and honorable thing.
Your courage... Their courage did not end on the battlefield, but extends to this very day and beyond. In the joy and profound emotional healing you help to bring to families in Japan.
Several other speakers said the gesture of reconciliation is not just about a flag. They said the flag carries the spirit of its owner home. I'm Tom Bonsi in Astoria.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Still ahead, paid rest breaks for Washington's farm workers have long been required by state law, but standard piecework makes it difficult to allocate pay for breaks. Mark Cote is the attorney for plaintiffs seeking rest period pay.
You can't take pay from time spent working and use that pay and attribute it to these other hours that you have to pay for, these rest break hours.
Rowan Moore Garrity reports on a case that could affect orchards throughout the region. That story coming up right after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Partly cloudy until this afternoon, then mostly sunny. Highs in the mid-60s with light winds. And tonight, more clouds with overnight lows in the mid-40s. Continued light winds. Tomorrow, partly cloudy in the morning, mostly cloudy with a 50% chance of rain in the afternoon. More rain overnight tomorrow with highs tomorrow in the high 50s, lows in the mid-40s. The Washington State Supreme Court is weighing changes to the way farm workers get paid. At issues are rest breaks, just 10 or 20 minutes out of the workday. But as Rowan Moore Garrity reports, the verdict could have far-reaching impacts on the state's fruit industry.
Farmer Frank Lyle pays workers by the piece to pick cherries and prune grapevines.
This is an extremely productive plant.
At a vineyard in Prosser, he bends close to a vine to examine a pruner's handiwork.
You can see on the ground here where he's pruned these canes off.
Here, the task brings 39 cents a plant. Skilled pruners can earn about $600 a week. Different employees work at different speeds, but Lyle says piecework is a simple system that works.
Under the piece rate system, a person is really rewarded for their skill and ability. You don't begrudge anyone taking a break at any time. It's totally up to them.
Washington state law requires a paid 10-minute rest break for every 4 hours on the job. The question before the court is whether workers earning piece rates should be paid separately for these breaks, and if so, how much?
Because we are here at Heritage University and
the court recently hit the road to hear oral arguments in the farming town of Toppenish. It's a case brought by workers who harvested berries for Sukuma Brothers in the Skagit Valley. Since piece workers only earn money by the task, they say the piece rate doesn't pay for rest. Here is their lawyer, Mark Cody.
So you can't take pay from time spent working and use that pay and attribute it to these other hours that you have to pay for, these rest break hours.
But Sukuma's lawyer, Adam Belsberg, says the piece rate already takes rest breaks into account. He says Sukuma pays workers to do more than pick fruit.
To fill the bucket with fruit, to separate out the poor quality fruit, to go wait to have it weighed, and every 4 hours to take a 10-minute rest break.
That argument didn't get very far with the farm workers who showed up at the hearing, like Maria de Jesus Cruz Cuevas.
A mí me gustaría que este señor fuera a piscar cherry o manzana.
I'd like that lawyer to go pick cherries or apples, she says, so he'd know how much we sweat. Cuevas says most piece rate workers don't take the breaks the law requires because they're afraid to lose their jobs. Growers focused on an efficient harvest only want the fastest pickers on their crews. She says paying separately for breaks would create an incentive for workers to actually take them and lead to fewer workplace injuries. In 10 minutes, you have time to drink water, your body relaxes, and your mind works better. Farmers fear a verdict for workers would make for a lot more bookkeeping. How would you document rest breaks? And would rest be paid at minimum wage or something based on the piece rate? Bob Jones is a lawyer who oversaw labor enforcement for the state of California, where a court ruled in 2013 that rest breaks have to be paid separately.
I think that if the Washington Supreme Court takes a good hard look at this, they will see what's developed in California, and that is that this is virtually impossible to administer where you have different types of pay rates for employees on the same day.
Jones says uncertainties over the future of piecework extend to industries like trucking, construction, and apparel. And while the Washington case deals with state law, it's attracted interest from labor groups around the country, just like previous campaigns to raise the minimum wage.
There's already a move to take these types of systems and minimum wages and protections in California and Washington and Massachusetts
and roll them out nationally. Whether Washington will serve as a national example on rest breaks is up to the court. It's expected to rule in the next 6 months. In Toppenish, I'm Rowan Moore Garrity.
The U.S. soldier, held for nearly 5 years as a prisoner of the Taliban, is facing charges of desertion and misbehavior before the enemy. Sergeant Bo Bergdahl left his post in 2009. He was released last May in a controversial prisoner swap. Correspondent Jessica Robinson reports from Bergdahl's hometown of Haley, Idaho, where people have become reluctant to speak publicly about him.
I'm standing here on Main Street in Haley, and a year ago you could have looked up and down the street and seen yellow ribbons on every tree and lamppost in honor of Bo Bergdahl. But things have changed since last May, and now many longtime supporters say they just don't want to comment and attract more attention to the town. For many years, it was almost the opposite. People in this town of about 8,000 in south central Idaho made it their mission to spread the word about the POW. They organized letter-writing drives to the president and planted trees in the city park for each year Bergdahl had been held captive. There was an annual rally that brought hundreds of veterans on motorcycles from across the West. Then in May, Bergdahl was released. The Obama administration traded him for 5 prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, though without consulting Congress. On top of that, Bergdahl's release was accompanied by details about the strange circumstances of his capture. Former members of his unit said he had deserted and walked off into the Afghan mountains. Bergdahl's release was initially a moment of celebration in Haley, but within days, the town had canceled an event to honor Bergdahl. Organizers said they'd received threats and worried the celebration would attract protesters. This week, the Army formally issued its charges against Bergdahl.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming to Fort Bragg today.
Colonel Daniel J.W. King told reporters, Bergdahl has been charged with desertion, which has a maximum penalty of 5 years imprisonment. He's also charged with misbehavior before the enemy by endangering the safety of a command, unit, or place. King says that charge has a much higher punishment.
Possible confinement for life.
After that announcement, the mayor of Haley issued a statement. It said the town would take no position on the Army's case. The town of Haley was quiet again. A dirt road just outside of Haley will take you through the canyon where Bergdahl grew up. Bergdahl's parents have remained silent since his release. There's a chain around the front gate and no answer on their phone. Minna Kasser sits at her dining room table in her home just down the road from the Bergdahls. She remembers Bo as the neighbor boy who taught her daughter fencing in the garage. It was around noon on Wednesday when Kasser got a text about the charges.
And was actually at lunch with some friends, and we were all, everyone at this point, I think, wasn't too surprised by something finally coming out. And yeah, people have been waiting to find out what's going to happen.
Kasser says they always knew Bergdahl's case would be complicated. And now that the Army is calling it desertion, some people in Haley agree he should be court-martialed.
I know that there's some people that are pretty upset and angry, but a lot of people, because he's from our town and he's a young man, and people make bad decisions and people have a lot of challenges in life, and there's a lot of area between complete black and complete white.
Kasser says she's happy Bergdahl's return has been a relief for his parents. Desertion charges, at least, are an improvement to where Bergdahl was a year ago. I'm Jessica Robinson reporting.
Last Saturday, in a public ceremony, people celebrated the life of former University of Oregon President Dave Frohnmayer. The memorial was held at the U of O campus at Matthew Knight Arena in Eugene. Rachel McDonald was there.
Dignitaries, elected officials, and members of the public joined the Frohnmayer family to honor a man who was president of the U of O for 15 years. Dave Frohnmayer was also state attorney general, and he served in the Oregon legislature. His friend Bill Gary described Frohnmayer as a man as comfortable arguing a case before the Supreme Court as hanging out with Oregon grass farmers.
Dave Frohnmayer was a gift to us all. He enriched our lives. He inspired us. He made us want to be better people.
State Senator Betsy Johnson said Frohnmayer was the type of leader it's hard to find anymore. He was a centrist Republican who searched for common ground, an approach she said has almost disappeared.
Dave was no different than so many of us who have devoted ourselves to the public life of Oregon. The difference? He simply chose to conduct himself as a man of humility and civility in search of the center.
Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden was one of Dave Frohnmayer's first students at the U of O Law School in 1971.
Professor Frohnmayer certainly came to play every day. He made legalese typically about as captivating as a Senate filibuster. He made it come alive.
Wyden and others pointed out that Dave Frohnmayer's legacy is apparent all over the U of O campus. His brother John Frohnmayer talked about what Dave would expect of those he left behind.
What the answer is for each of us depends upon our individual talents. But what he would say to all of us, I know, is use those talents in the service of humanity.
Besides his public service, Dave Frohnmayer and his wife Lynn founded the Fanconi Anemia Research Fund. They lost 2 daughters to the genetic blood disease. Frohnmayer died earlier this month after fighting prostate cancer for 5 years. Music was a huge part of Frohnmayer's life. This was reflected at the memorial. The U of O men's choir performed a song he wrote for his wife. I'm Rachel McDonald at the University of Oregon in Eugene.
Touch on me.